all around the water tank, waiting for a train. A thousand miles away from home, sleeping in the rain.
A scratchy record, a reedy voice, an old song that must mean that our resident historian Felix Bunnell has climbed his way out of the Cairo crypt and is here to introduce us to another moment in history. And I gather this morning we're talking about the railroads, eh?
Yeah, it's Burlington Northern Santa Fe is the big railroad around here, but it's made up from all these other smaller railroads that get their start as early as the 1870s. You know, because in the old days when settlers first arrived here, it was about water, rivers, salt water. That's how you got around. That's how merchandise was moved. But by the end of the 19th century, it was a railroad, unquestionably, that tied everyone together from Pacific Northwest across the country to move goods and services and move people back and forth with relative ease. And there's these great old romantic names of railroads around here, like the Northern Pacific or the Great Northern, or one of my favorites, the Milwaukee Road.
Yes.
It evokes a whole different era. But all those were combined into BNSF. First, it was Burlington Northern in 1970, then BNSF back in 1995. So it turns out, in addition to all the real estate and railroad lines they combined, they also consolidated these incredible collections of old maps and documents from about 200 railroads, and they're all in an archive in Fort Worth, Texas. BNSF has about 100,000 real estate maps in their collection, and 1,700 of these cover some part of what's now the state of Washington. So I spoke a few days ago with the archivist for BNSF in Fort Worth. Her name's Ashley Jeffis. She told me there were two main types of maps that railroads commissioned long ago. One was a right-of-way map, which showed the ownership of property where rail lines ran. The other was a station map showing all the rails and sidings and listing all the names of businesses along the tracks. One of the maps in the BNSF collection is the Seattle station map made for the Milwaukee Road back in 1928.
This particular map shows the area near the Lander Street Wharf. It shows grain and feed warehouses. There's a carpenter shop that's linked to a furniture warehouse, flour mills, and then the expected fishing and packing houses that would be along the dock. We also have, farther away from the dock, Sears Roebuck Co., and even a small carriage building business. So these station maps really may be the only record that these businesses existed in that place at that time.
You know, and we have a gallery of these at My Northwest. We have samples of all these different cool maps. Go check those out, because they've shared these with us, which is awesome. So they also have a right-of-way map for Seattle from 1921, made for the Great Northern. Shows the rail lines along King Street. Shows the route of that underground downtown tunnel.
The tunnel,
which,
yeah.
Exactly which blocks and streets it goes under. It's very cool. All the way up to Interbay, where the railroad yards are. Now, you know, most of the maps in the collection, they're one-of-a-kind, hand-drawn, custom pieces that were not mass-produced. You know, these aren't gas station maps, but they were used and treated like gas station maps for decades by rough-and-tumble railroad people who, you know, folded them, they wrote on them, they stuffed them in their dusty briefcases. So BNSF has been conserving and preserving all of them.
All of the maps were put through a process where a plant-based putty was run over the base of them to remove any surface dirt. And for some of these maps, there was a whole lot of surface dirt. Then we sometimes painstakingly removed all of the tape that had been put on the map to hold it together, since this historic tape could be very acidic and continue to damage the map over time. And then we used acid-free tape as well as acid-free papers to repair any holes, sometimes putting maps that were in pieces back together.
Yeah, and they're also digitizing them. And in this big library in Fort Worth, it's not open to the public. They let some scholars in, you know, on a case-by-case basis. You know, Ashley Jeffis, she spent so much time with what I consider works of art. I asked her if she ever recognizes particular map makers by their drawing technique, or if she gets some sense of who the map makers were.
You kind of get a sense of the work, especially in some of the early filing maps. Filing maps were done very, very early for the Northern Pacific, and most of them were the first survey perhaps done of that area. So in addition to cities and towns, they would also map the topography. So you would see these beautiful lakes drawn and filled out and colored in, mountains, rivers, specific islands. And sometimes some of the most interesting part is you see local names for land masses or mountains that may not be in use today that were used at the time.
Yeah. I mean, so this is really a treasure trove. It's kind of, it belongs to BNSF and will probably always be in their collection, but it's just this amazing thing, you know. And that kind of map she described, a filing map, there's one in the BNSF collection. It's the oldest map from Washington that they have. It's from the Northern Pacific in 1873, and it shows that earliest of rail lines, which went from Kalama on the Columbia River all the way up to Tacoma. And so it's all hand-drawn and hand-colored exactly the way she described, and you can see that at My Northwest. As I was talking to Ashley, I got to thinking about all those old railroad guys using those maps 100 years ago, and I asked her, you know, does she ever find obvious cigar burns or tobacco juice stains or other evidence of the maps being in circulation in the old days?
Lots of coffee stains, some questionable smells. Mylar, when it breaks down, has the worst smell you've ever smelled. So, yeah, sometimes processing these maps was an olfactory adventure.
Yeah, it's just a really cool collection. To have this little sample they've shared with us is just unbelievable. So check it out at My Northwest.
It's interesting to see how straight those lines were back then.
Oh, God.
There's
artists.
Nothing in the way.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A couple of houses and then a river and nothing else.
Felix Spinell joins us each Wednesday on Seattle's Morning News, and all his features are posted at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
7:15, Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And Hannah Scott, every morning I come in, Hannah Scott is there pounding away her computer. She is our legislative watchdog, the hardest working woman in the newsroom. And the issues that they're dealing with, basically every talk show issue is now up for grabs in the legislature. Vaccines, plastic bags, school safety, standardized testing. So where should we start? Vaccines?
Vaccines, right? This has been getting a lot of attention both here in this Washington and, of course, the other Washington yesterday with our measles outbreak. Now 71 cases, I believe, down in Clark County. So there are a couple of different bills that are moving through the legislature. One has yet to be voted on in the full Senate. That would do away with our personal or philosophical exemptions for all vaccines. Another version in the House does away with the philosophical exemption or personal exemption choice for just the MMR vaccine. That's the one that came up for a House floor vote last night. It comes from Republican Representative Paul Harris of Vancouver, where that outbreak is right now.
We need our community immunity to be high. In the states that have passed this, it has raised their community immunity. Clark County, we were at about 75 to 80%. Typically in states that get rid of the personal exemption, it raises between 5 and 8%. It'll make us safer. It'll make our community safer.
But his fellow Vancouver Republican, Representative Vicky Kraft, strongly disagreed.
I am urging a very, very, very strong no vote so that our parents' voices are not taken away and that the parents can decide for their children what they feel is best for their child's health and health care.
So the big argument ends up being, of course, personal choice for parents. And it's those parents, hundreds, remember, packed the state legislature earlier this year when these hearings came up about these bills. Because parents, there is a small percentage of kids who have some adverse reaction, which can be anything from a fever to something a little more extreme.
In terms of rights, what about the rights of other parents who don't want their kids to get sick?
Right. So that's the argument, right? Because those kids who can't, and those are the ones that really get focused on here. There are kids who simply cannot get vaccinated and therefore are not. They have a medical exemption, right?
Yeah.
And they are the most at risk. They are the ones we see mostly right now that are coming down with these measles cases. So that's the argument you get as far as those parents with the personal exemption. At any rate, this one has moved off the House floor. Every Republican except for Paul Harris voted against it. The Senate version of this is also expected to come up for a vote here shortly. Over in the Senate, though, other late night action last night came in the war on plastics, as one day after approving new restrictions on plastic straws, the Senate approved a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags at retailers. Democrat Mona Doss behind this bill.
We all know that waste generated by plastic bags is a huge problem for the environment. We know that the bill won't eliminate the plastic waste in Washington state, but we think it's a good step on our journey to protect the environment.
Republican Senator Doug Erickson cast doubt on the impact of single-use plastic bags on the environment to begin with. But one of the big things that came out in this debate is the original bill would have charged stores and retailers can still give out plastic bag, a reusable plastic bag of certain kind, and also a paper bag. It was going to charge 10 cents for each of those bags. Mm-hmm. But somewhere in this debate last night, it went down to 8 cents, and Doug Erickson had an issue with that.
The fact that we as a legislature think that we are able to determine the cost of a bag in a free market society is just unbelievable to me, which perhaps leads me to believe that we actually are not living in a free market society in today's Washington, but fast moving towards a state-run system where the legislature gets to pick prices for all of your commodities. Very dangerous pathway we're on tonight.
Oh, here we go, the specter of socialism. I mean, is
Venezuela came up shortly after.
Venezuela, of course. I don't think the problem there is just socialism. The idea of charging fees to change behavior on bags, was there any data at all presented to indicate whether that's working or not?
No, not during the debate.
Because it doesn't work with me.
Yeah.
I mean, if I want a paper bag and they say 5 cents, okay, fine. What's 5 cents, you know? So did anybody bring up, I know I keep harping on this, who is letting these plastic bags escape from the landfills? Because I don't see most people just throwing plastic bags out of their car so they can blow into the sound. How are they getting in there?
No, and again, it didn't come up, but Doug Erickson did point out exactly what you're saying, and he's saying, look, again, he said the big threat was from certain kinds of bags that are coming from China. That's what is ending up in our oceans, not anything from Washington State. Again, just like we talked about with straws, the idea here was this is one little step that we can do to change behavior to make sure that they don't end up in there. A lot of these school safety measures also cleared off the Senate floor last night. One of them is to have new training for school resource officers. This has to do with de-escalation and mental health training. There's another one that requires all police agencies to let every school, including private schools, know if there's something going on in the area that would require a lockdown or evacuation of some sort. The other one that came off the floor was the ERPO bill, Extreme Risk Protection Orders, applying them to minors, which we've talked about before. That's allowing your gun rights to be temporarily taken away. Basically, what this does allows a judge to consider issuing an ERPO against a minor if they're, you know, exhibiting disturbing behavior, mental health crisis, suicidal thoughts, things like that, at which point the police would then have to go to that kid's parents and say, look, this order has been issued. You have to lock up your gun. Keep it away from the kid. You're on notice.
They're not going to take your guns, but they will require you to lock them up.
An early version there was that might have been a little more extreme where you had to give your guns over. This just simply tells the parents you're responsible and you're going to be held accountable if your kid gets this gun. That seems fair to me. Yeah, it was very fair. In fact, we got Republican Senator John Braun on board.
It's a simple question. If one of my children was in this situation where this type of protective order was required, would I want this law in place and would I want to be notified? And for me, the answer is yes.
And only five Republicans voted against this, Braun and several.
This was genuinely bipartisan.
Absolutely
no
bipartisan.
No pushback from the NRA, no threats to primary them if they vote for this bill or anything like that.
No, I mean, we've heard throughout, there's a few different ERPO bills moving through the session, and the NRA has testified against all of them, and they're now testifying against ERPOs in general. They've got a variety of issues. But they didn't say anything more about this bill than any others. This was a brainchild. It was bipartisan from the get-go of Democrat David Frocht and Republican Senator Steve O'Bann worked on this together.
Good for them.
A really good example of bipartisanship down in Olympia. One quick thing we want to get to, delinking of standardized tests from graduation. This happened a little earlier this week. There are three different bills moving through the legislature that would delink these standardized testing from graduation requirements in our state. It's been a long ongoing debate. One passed earlier this week that simply delinks that standardized test requirement. But there are a couple of others that Superintendent Chris Rakedahl has hopes that they get through instead.
There's a second version of bills that are hanging out there that say we're going to also delink. The test won't be required. You don't have to pass a test to graduate, but once we learn from the test that you might be struggling in a subject area or a content area, we got to design some classwork for you here and a career pathway for you here that makes sense so you have the skills when you graduate to be successful, even if it's not academic course taking like the test drive. So
essentially, there's a couple of bills. One creates this pathway where you'd have to there's like 13 different things where you can go to the military, go do something like get an apprenticeship. And those are both where they could be pulled for a floor vote at any time.
We might go back to handing out diplomas to kids who haven't learned the material is what we're saying.
But making sure that they're ready for whatever they have to do after graduation. And that actually, there's a lot more to it. There are plans, four-year plans involved in some of these other bills he's talking about where you'd have to have this plan and know what it is you want to do once you get out of school. And you'd have to meet those kind of requirements through one of these 13 pathways by the time you graduate. So,
Hannah Scott, our legislative detective, thank you.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. High school is tough for many. When you're in a wheelchair, navigating high school, even harder. But lucky for Brandon Qualls, he has a friend in Tanner Wilson.
Every single day, he helps anybody.
Tanner is Brandon's friend, no doubt. But he's a friend that kept a secret for 2 years. The Norman, Arkansas teen saved up his money for 2 years to buy his buddy Brandon an electric wheelchair, an upgrade and relief for Tanner. He was presented the wheelchair this week.
He's an amazing friend. It was amazing to me because I didn't know what he had done for me.
Tears of joy, but now he's all smiles. And his humble friend Tanner says this is just what anyone should do for a friend.
For the past 3 years, I've wanted to get him one. And, I mean, I've been trying. I feel like life's a little bit too short to be, you know, judging everybody. And, you know, you should think more of others than just yourself.
For now, the chair is being kept at school. Brandon's family has to save up to get a car for the electric wheelchair, perhaps a new endeavor for the friends of Brandon.
And here he is from Peoria, the man who the moment he landed in Arizona was the state's biggest prickly cactus. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. So, how did Felix Bonnell... Look, yes, Felix Bonnell. How did Felix Hernandez...
Felix Bonnell specialized in history, and his best stuff came from about 78 years
did he?
Ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
he's a really talented guy, though. He can write entire holiday productions.
That's right.
While, used up all your brain power writing that cactus joke.
I know, that's exactly right. So, tell me about the pitching
cactus
yesterday.
Cactus joke was good.
Thank you.
Well, Felix took the mound against the KT Wiz, which is a Korean baseball team. I'm really impressed. I like the name, the KT Wiz. And he looked great for the first two innings. He struck out four in the first two innings. He retired the side in order in the first and had one walk in the second and ran into a little bit of trouble in the third. There was a error, it looked like, at third base, and that was followed up a little bit by a two-run double down the line. Opposing hitter went the other way, and then he gave up a two-run homer in the fourth inning. Here's the problem: is that you can't read too much into the results, because a lot of times guys are out there, and for Felix's case, it's not necessarily about overpowering the hitters he's facing. He might be working on something or trying something. Here's what it looked like: is that his breaking stuff, his slider and his curveball was extremely good, which is a positive sign, and they want him to use his curve more. His fastball location was a struggle, and that's a problem and something that has tended to get him in trouble, because when he struggles with his location, he'll start throwing over fatter parts of the plate. So fastball command seemed to continue to be an issue. This wasn't a step forward. I don't know how big a concern it is, though, and we're moving ahead. I don't think there's any doubts about him being on the mound and in the rotation to start the season, but that question of how long he's going to stay with the club, I think, is very much an open one.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, to be honest, it doesn't sound like King Felix is going to take us to the playoffs.
No, I don't think so. And if you ask me my opinion, I think that this is, we'll look to see midway through May where the staff is in terms of its health. We talked to Justice Sheffield yesterday, who is kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum. He's now the top prospect in the Mariners organization, someone they acquired in the trade for James Paxton. He's probably going to start the season in the minor leagues, and some of that has to do with making sure he's ready. Some of it has to do with preserving a year of keeping him cheaper as a player for an extra year. By keeping him down into mid-May, they preserve an extra year before he's eligible for arbitration. Essentially, it's a bookkeeping method of keeping him cheaper for an extra year. As opposed to if he was there for the start of the year, you would essentially lose a year of service time that they otherwise might not. So, but Justice Sheffield is someone you look toward the future, and I found myself, it's much more fun at this point, and so something I'm enjoying more as a Mariners fan, is imagining the possibility of guys like Justice Sheffield and some of the other players that they've acquired. We talked to Shed Long as well. Rather than kind of questioning, like, okay, how much does Felix have left? Because here's the reality, is the past 2 years, the Mariners have really been relying, the past 3 years, the Mariners have really been relying on Felix, and he was crucial to them getting to the playoffs. It's a real long shot, even if Felix was dominant this year, for them to get to the playoffs. Felix has more on the line this year than the Mariners do. Felix is pitching to continue his career, and the Mariners, in many ways, are now planning and moving toward a future without Felix, regardless of what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is Domingo Santana? He got some attention.
He did. He's one of the new players that they've acquired, a guy who had been with Houston, and he hit a homer, his third of the spring, and another outfielder, Jake Fraley, who was acquired in Tampa Bay in the trade for Mike Zunino. He had a double as well as a home run yesterday. It was his second of the spring. So those are another couple guys. Domingo Santana is a player who showed some tremendous pop a couple years ago. I'm sorry, they didn't acquire him from the Astros. They acquired him from the Brewers for Ben Gamel. And Domingo Santana was hurt a little bit, banged up, and he fell out of their rotation. He wasn't one of their best outfielders after the Brewers had acquired a guy down from Tampa, Christian Yelich. And it looks like Domingo Santana is a guy who could have a bounce back year, and in the increased playing time opportunity, this could pan out. He's one of the guys that the Mariners picked up with the idea of, hey, Milwaukee's kind of moved on from him, but this guy might fit with what we're doing. And you try a couple changes with his swing, and maybe he gets back into being a top tier hitting outfielder like he really looked like he was going to be a couple years ago.
Did Ichiro make any appearance yet?
I saw Ichiro 2 days ago. It was yesterday, because Shed Long said konnichiwa to him, and Ichiro responded with konnichiwa. And then, I don't know, a crass term that was popularized by the Dave Chappelle skit. So Ichiro showing his wry sense of humor. And then I saw a picture of Ichiro with Julio Rodriguez. And Julio Rodriguez is one of two young outfielders. He's just 18 years old. He's from the Dominican Republic. And he is one of two young outfielders that are really linchpin prospects for the Mariners down the road, guys with huge ceilings and could be absolute franchise-changing superstars. And there was a picture of Julio Rodriguez with Ichiro, and he talked about being with the legend. Ichiro looks as in shape as he has ever.
Really?
He's 45 years old, and if it weren't for the gray hairs, and he does have gray hairs, there's some salt peppered in there, he would look exactly like he did when he got here in 2001.
Excellent. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
I'm going to go find someone to prick as a cactus.
Don't tell them I sent you. Anna Scott is here, and the subject is teen sexting and what should happen to teens who do it. Right now, they can end up facing felony charges for having or sharing sexually explicit photos of other teenagers. And some lawmakers think that's going too far. So, Hannah, where does this stand?
So this is a bill that's come up before, and earlier this week it was approved by the House. Ahead of the floor vote, Democratic sponsor Representative Nicole Frame explained the problem with the current law.
The majority of today's teenagers communicate using smartphones and other internet-connected devices. And Mr. Speaker, we may not want to think about it, but several studies tell us about 20% of kids are using their phones to send sexually explicit images of themselves, oftentimes with a romantic partner. The disconnect between state law and current uses of technology by teenagers are creating the unintended consequence of lifelong barriers to success for teenagers.
So here's 20%.
In the days before smartphones, did people exchange like Polaroids of themselves? I think recall that being a thing.
Maybe. I doubt it was as widely done as what we see now, because they can. They do. Right?
What? But sketch it. I'm just kidding.
It's. But I think
cave drawings.
Adults have sent some bad examples, and I think because they have smartphones, they can and they do. So that's the way it goes. But here's what she means about lifelong consequences. Under the current law, there is no distinction between kids and adults when it comes to possessing child porn. So teen sexting or sending sexually explicit pictures of themselves with one another can face the same felony charge for possessing child porn as an adult and be required to register as a sex offender. And the same goes for sharing criminal penalties. Sharing sexually explicit images of another person for a third party, all amongst teenagers. Several lawmakers, including Representative Brad Clippert, are strongly opposed to this bill, which would lower all of those felonies to some sort of misdemeanor.
There are standards of conduct that must be held, a moral quality, a moral standard that must stand in this nation and cannot be crossed. And what this bill allows is a moral standard that cannot be crossed in this nation, in our schools.
And he especially took issue with lowering criminal penalties for kids sharing pictures of other kids engaged in sex acts, which he said can involve bullying or shaming and can lead to suicides in teens. But the bill's sponsor, Representative Frame, countered that having such tough penalties also puts the kids at risk.
Teenagers who have created or shared explicit images may be reluctant to seek adult help for fear of them being prosecuted themselves. Our schools and our parents, they're even reluctant to intervene when something's happening because they know that all of the kids involved, even the kids whose image may have been shared without their consent, all kids involved will be subject to a Class B felony sex offense, and they will be treated as sex offenders.
So that's because it's possession of child porn, right? So if somebody, you ended up with that picture, you're afraid to open it, you're afraid to tell your mom, you're afraid to tell the cops because you could be charged with a felony. That's what this is trying to undo. Jimmy Hong is with the King County Prosecutor's Office Juvenile Division, and he supports the bill. And he says that the important thing to remember when it comes to kids using these images to harass is there are other charges they could face.
In instances where kids are engaging in that level of behavior that's even more concerning, we can still charge them with harassment, or, for example, or cyber stalking. And so there are other crimes in the book that fit, you know, that additional level of severity, if you will. And so it allows us to address and appropriately address that conduct.
So it would not go unpunished.
It would not. If we're talking about harassment or bullying or something like that, they can charge to up to felony harassment.
So even if this bill was passed to try and go a little easier on kids who send these pictures, they would not go unpunished.
They would not in these extreme cases where a third image, like an image not just between a boyfriend-girlfriend type couple, but they could share it or post it on Snapchat to shame a person or whatever,
which
harass.
Which we've heard of, though, even young men who share it with their friends by sending it to their friends when it's not meant as harassment but as a, look what I got sent,
right.
Would that count as a possible felony charge?
It wouldn't, not under what they're trying to do here. Right now,
so
you
malicious
bet.
Intent
right now it does.
Needs
yeah.
to be proven under this bill.
Yeah, okay. And that we have felony harassment laws and things like that. If it's an extreme case, it would be up to the prosecutor. And another thing that I want to point out is that Jimmy Hong of the Prosecutor's Office Juvenile Division says there are a lot of concerns about older teens not facing penalties for making actual child porn with this bill. That's not the case.
If you're a teenager, let's say you're 16 or 17, and you are producing pornography involving a child who's six, then you don't get the benefit of these changes.
So under this bill, that leaves the only felony, something like that, is you could still charge as a felony. Everything else would be either a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor. All of the other types of things we've been talking about, sharing images with one another, a third party, that would be diverted on the first thing. You wouldn't be charged. You'd get counseling and things like that. And then anything after that, then you would face the misdemeanor charges.
How about requiring that cell phone cameras can be disabled by parents?
I like that.
Yeah, you know, it's worth a conversation because parents have the choice to try to do that.
Give them a flip phone. That's all you got to do is replace it with a burner.
You're obviously not going to take the phones away from kids anymore, but a requirement that all cell phones sold in Washington State, which you know, it might force Apple to update the operating system, must include a control such that parents can shut off the cameras of their kids' phones.
But then you're
NSA
mandating.
Spy.
Oh, what?
The NSA spy did.
Yeah, well,
I think this
still
goes back
to the NSA.
You asked, like, why are kids, you know, sending pictures of themselves? I think it goes back to how we are raising and talking to kids about sex. And
yes.
A lot of this, you know, when we sneak and look at magazines when we're younger, when we get online and look at porn when we're younger, oftentimes it's because we're discovering our own sexuality. We're curious. Nobody's talking to us about what's appropriate, what should be normalized with sex. And so you sneak these things and you take part in riskier and riskier behavior. You know, this is just my amateur, you know, parental analysis of the issue is you do see sexual repression. All the generations have. But today, this is how it's expressing itself, is in taking pictures, engaging in this risky behavior of putting it out there.
It's a lot worse, though. I think this is a lot worse than somebody sneaking a peek at a magazine. These are actual kids who are seeing their images shared throughout the
classroom.
Exactly.
This is just the modern day expression of that sexual repression and taking that risky behavior. So I just talk to your kids about sex, for Pete's sake.
I'm going to tell you what right now. I think that this happens, as you heard, 20%. The minute I gave my kid a smartphone, I told her there will be no taking any kind of pictures like this and sharing among friends ever. It was one of the first things I told her. She was like 12 years old. I don't know that most parents do that. I don't know if I'm right or wrong,
well,
but I said it because it
my
matters
kid would
to me.
Never do it. My kid would never do it.
And I don't think
like,
you
yeah,
can
right.
say that about anything
no.
anymore.
Yeah.
Technology is ahead of all of us when it comes to our kids, period. You have to have the talk.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. Buyer's remorse is a drag, especially when it's over the biggest purchase in your life. Here is Rachel Bell.
38-year-old Marissa Sullivan bought her first house 2 years ago in Portland.
You know, I don't want to sound like it was the worst idea of my life, but
she does have some regrets. And so do a lot of her peers. A new study by Bankrate.com says nearly two-thirds of millennials, that's 23 to 38-year-olds, regret buying their home. That's more than any other age group.
Learning how to say no to brunch, learning how to say no to vacations, that's definitely where the regret kicks in. which was something that I really didn't have to do before because my rent was so cheap. I have been able to kind of live a fun lifestyle.
Bankrate analyst Deborah Kern says the majority of the regrets were definitely money related.
We saw that a quarter of them said that it was the unexpected repair and maintenance costs that came with a home that they weren't anticipating. Maybe in the first year or two of home ownership, when your furnace goes out or an AC blows, that's a big upfront cost that if you've just bought a home, chances are your savings might be slim because you've just dumped all of that into a down payment and closing costs.
She says 12% of people said they regret buying such a small home, and 8% say they picked a bad neighborhood. That is the case for Seattle's 36-year-old Jamie Dedmond. She regrets moving so close to Highway 99.
So we get a lot of homeless people jumping our fence. We've actually had 3 people try to break in when I had a brand new baby in the house.
79% of people surveyed for this study consider buying a home to be the epitome of achieving the American dream. And Jamie admits she got a little wrapped up trying to get to this next stage of adulthood.
100%. It was definitely the next step in our lives together. We both looked at it as though we need to buy a house if we're going to be in Seattle, especially if the rents were rising like they were. And it just felt like this kind of sense of urgency.
Marissa was also hearing the siren song of adulthood.
Maybe let ego get in the way a little bit. Like, I'm old enough to own something. This should be something I should do, you know, almost like it looks good on paper, you know? And I probably wasn't quite ready, but I have been making it work, but it's not without a lot of stress.
Marissa has made it work by renting out her spare bedrooms on Airbnb. But after one too many negative experiences and feeling isolated in the part of town she chose to buy in.
I didn't tell you this yet, but I actually moved out of my house and I'm Airbnb-ing the whole house full time because I've had these regrets and these struggles with just sort of staying afloat and, you know, trying to some sort of social life. So that's sort of the newest chapter on this homeowning.
When I read the new study, I wasn't surprised. Homeownership seems to go against the core values of millennials. Other studies and surveys I've read say millennials value experiences over stuff. They like to travel and move around a lot. But through her regret, Marissa acknowledges that the equity will eventually be worth it.
I know it won't be this hard forever, and it's only year 2, and year 1 of owning a home is definitely the hardest year. Everybody says that, and then you kind of start, you know, seeing the market go up and everything starts making sense, because I know it's going to pay off. I know that just because I regret it right now and it's really hard, I haven't had a lot of hardship in my life, so maybe it's good for me, but it doesn't stop me from, you know, having regrets.
So Rachel, this sounds like Adulting is Hard, episode 47. What do you expect when you buy a house?
Well, that's why I was wondering if this was something unique to current millennials or if this is something that has happened for generations with any first-time home buyer. The thing that I thought was interesting that I took from it was this idea of feeling pressure to live the American dream, like I'm supposed to buy a house. They end up buying a house that's farther away from their friends or their job or the stuff they like to do just to buy the house. And they're starting to think, you know, were these compromises worth it?
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that the real estate industry advertises this as everybody's goal. I mean, you're not really grown up until you have a house of your own.
Right.
And the way I look at it is, when you buy a house, what you really are buying is the right to fix it up for the next guy.
That's true. That's what my parents did. I felt like as soon as we were about to move, they suddenly put in new floors. And I'm like, we would have enjoyed these floors.
Why didn't you
Why
do
did
that?
We have to live
because
with the other stuff?
Because you would have ruined them, you say.
Exactly.
I don't think it's a mystery that when you own something, you're responsible for everything that happens to it.
Yeah, I love having a landlord. It is my favorite thing to
call him
and say, this is broken. And then I leave and they fix it while I'm gone. It's my favorite thing. Yeah, because you hear a lot of people saying, you know, oh, if you're paying rent, you're just throwing your money away. I don't think so. I mean, there's a trade-off. Like, the trade-off for that is freedom. You're not attached to this house. You don't have to spend $10,000 when, you know, whatever breaks. So you just have to choose. There's other ways to invest your money. And that's something that you just have to somehow figure out yourself through reading and research and maybe talking to somebody.
Right.
That might be part of it too. You know, there's a lot of stuff like that. I mean, myself included, like trying to figure out the mortgage stuff and talking to lenders. I had zero idea about any of that. You know, I mean, we really have like a very narrow education about things in life until they pop up and you have to suddenly, I'm buying a house. I got to learn about this real quick. Do you have any regrets about buying your house?
Not really. Every time I pay the property tax, Yes.
Yeah.
But then when I see what it's worth, no.
Right.
Got rid of Rachel Bell. Just in case you think of buying a house, my experience is we've owned our house for 30 years. We have replaced the siding, two chimneys, the driveway, the patio, parts of the foundation. What am I leaving out here? Oh, the roof. Yes. Yeah. And the windows.
Yep.
All at my expense. So there you go.
God, I weep for the fact that no one seems to have any sense of self-reliance, responsibility, and wanting everybody else to take care of them. What happened to us?
I don't know.